Quick reminder, Linguistics Career Launch 2024 is happening very soon in 1 week, starting July 15th, 2024. If you're a linguist looking for a job outside academia, LCL 24 is the two-week event that will jumpstart your career journey. LCL events are open to undergraduate and graduate students, postdocs, faculty, and alum. In fact, career linguists as well. In short, anyone who wants to transition from academia to industry or just improve their own industry profile. There will be workshops, panels, interviews, financial planning sessions, and much more. There are still some spaces left, so register now. Tickets are available at Eventbrite. Please visit linguisticscareerlaunch.com for more information. Serena Williams received her PhD from UC Davis. She is a linguistic entrepreneur who leads walking tours, does genealogy research, is writing a textbook, developing K-12 linguistics courses, and is even writing a memoir about her time spent doing van life with her daughter while teaching her lessons tailored to the places they were visiting. She founded both the Language and Heritage Institute and Kronos Heritage Services. Topics discussed include genealogy, entrepreneurship, work environment, translation, language rights, language access, and language justice. Links to Serena's LinkedIn profile and other resources mentioned are in the show notes. Serena, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Well, thank you for having me.
I am excited to talk with you about all the various things that you've done in your career and your entrepreneurship. But as always, I like to start by asking people, how did you find out about linguistics and get interested in it?
Yeah, I didn't get into linguistics until really relatively late to a lot of people. I had no idea what linguistics was the entire time I was doing my undergraduate degree, which was in Spanish. And, you know, when you do a foreign language degree, it's a little bit of language, a little bit of literature, film, kind of, you know, culture and history. And I loved it all. And I ended up going to the University of Washington for my master's in Spanish literature. And I was a TA teaching Spanish. And there were these other people in my TA office who also taught Spanish. And they were in the mysterious linguistics department. And that was my introduction to linguistics. I was like, what do you study? I don't even understand what it is. Do you just study grammar all the time? So that's where I got my education. And I was already in a literature degree, you know, in that program. And when I finished my master's degree, I ended up moving across the country from Washington to New York. And I was trying to figure out what I was going to do with the move. The move was like a necessary move. And so it was, you know, I had to figure out what to do with myself. Mm-hmm. And I said, hey, how about I go and get a master's degree in this mysterious linguistics? And so I did. And that's how I got into it. So it all sounds kind of like, you know, how about I do this? And I don't know. I don't really want to kind of downplay the decisions that people make, but in some ways, those are the ways that people make a lot of decisions.
Yeah, just what is fortuitous at the time, right? Like,
right.
Opportunities appear and then you can take them or not take them. What was it about linguistics that intrigued you as opposed to what you'd been studying before that?
So the final quarter that I was at the University of Washington, I did take a Spanish linguistics course for, you know, I had already graduated, but I needed it for summer school in order to continue being a TA over the summer and get my money. And that was where I got hooked. I was like, oh, this is really interesting. I like phonetics, phonology. I like studying the structure. And it was a little bit of historical linguistics from Latin to Spanish. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of an introduction to everything. And I went, ooh, this is fun. That was really it. And so when I went out to New Jersey, and I was living in New York and studying in New Jersey and teaching in New Jersey, I started linguistics and went, yep, this is indeed very interesting stuff. I, of course, saw the connection to language teaching. But interestingly, even though language teaching is still very much an interesting area for me, I fell in love really with sociocultural linguistics.
Mm-hmm. And was that what your degree focused on? Specifically?
So my master's degree was basically applied linguistics for language teaching, and then my doctorate ended up being sociocultural linguistics.
Ah, okay, cool. And what did you think was going to happen to you after you finished your degree?
That's funny. I thought I was going to get a rank one tenure track job, but I had a spouse and a house and a baby when I finished my doctorate. And those things complicate the entire career. In addition to that, you know, I had taken a sort of long way around. So between that second master's degree and my doctorate, I worked for 5 years at a tenure track position. And I was in a Spanish department teaching Spanish language and literature. And that was a lot of fun. But I remember thinking, okay, I want to go back and get my doctorate. So I was a little bit older. And when you're a little bit older and you have a family, things are tougher, right?
Yeah,
I mean, those of us that go straight through, it's much easier to pursue that tenure track. So in any case, I couldn't find a job local or in a place that my spouse would agree to live in. And I don't say this to disparage my spouse at all, but, you know, his idea of what is the quality of life had no, there was nothing about like living in a place you don't want to live in for some number of years. He just thought that was a ridiculous thing. And I mean, if you really start to think about it, it kind of is ridiculous.
It is. It totally is. No, that's such a valid point. And it's one of those under-discussed things, right? It's sort of an assumption that is made when you're finishing your PhD or even your master's and you're looking for jobs. The location is more like, well, I guess I just have to take whatever's offered to me. Like, you don't really have a choice. It's just whatever job I happen to get, I guess that's where I'm going to move. Which is awful. Like, of course you need to think about where you're going to live. And for some folks, it is more than just, I don't want to live here. It's like, maybe this isn't a safe place for me to live. And that always has to be part of the equation when you're thinking about where you're going to spend the next, whatever, 5-10 years of your life.
And it's not just about family. I mean, it's for me too. What kind of quality of life do I want? I want to live in a place where I enjoy, you know, my daily life. Currently, I live in Central California, a couple hours from the beach, a couple hours from the mountains, lots of national parks. I go camping all the time, and I like to enjoy my life. And this is a place from which I can do that.
Yeah, totally. No, I feel the same way. You know, I don't want to shovel snow. That's a big part of it. And also thinking about the trajectory of your life too. Like, where do I want to, as you said, raise a family, but then also, you know, where do I want to grow old, right? What is available for me as I move through different phases of my life?
Sure. I want museums and I want wineries and I want national parks and state parks. And, you know, I want all these things for my life. And I don't think that that's like living that kind of quality of life where you have these aesthetic opportunities to enrich yourself, just for me is not something I'm willing to sacrifice.
Yeah, totally. So so you do that and you're like, oh, no R1 jobs for me.
Yes. we arrive at the crisis.
Yeah, exactly. The inciting incident, as they say. So what were you like, what kind of plans were you making at that point as far as how you were going to earn a living?
So I contacted a life coach, and what I told the life coach was, I have no skills. I said, I've been working in academia for 20 years, and I have no skills beyond teaching, research, writing. I read really well. I have like high reading comprehension. I'm multilingual. And I have this knowledge of linguistics. These are the skills I have. And this life coach, did you mind if I shout out her name?
Oh, please, go ahead.
Okay, so Jen Polk is a fantastic career coach for academics who are considering leaving academia and those who decide to. And I think her programs are fantastic. And she said, no, you have many more skills.
Yeah.
And with Jen, we listed hundreds of skills that are applicable from working on a doctorate to other things. And they're as simple as being able to navigate and manage a long-term project mm-hmm. as big as a dissertation,
yeah.
being able to hire other people and contract work out as a project manager is part of a lot of people's dissertations. And so as I started to look at, you know, all of this skill set that I had, I went, oh, you know what? A lot of what you're describing actually is applicable to this hobby I have, which is genealogy.
Mm-hmm.
Who doesn't love doing their family tree and mm-hmm. getting on and finding out about their ancestors? Well, some people don't. But for those that do, it can be a really big hobby. And so what I did was I started a company, and it's called Kronos Heritage Services, and it's a genealogy and genealogy travel company. Wow. So I take people on voyages to walk in the footsteps of their ancestors.
Wow. That's so cool. That is great. I totally relate to the falling down the genealogy rabbit hole. The good folks at Ancestry.com are very interested in that and have sort of, I feel like when they launched those websites, they just opened this up to people, because before that it had been so difficult to find records. Like, you had to go in person, and now mm-hmm. you can do most of this research online.
That's true.
That's amazing. So how did you launch the service?
So I had been doing it for myself and my husband's tree and friends for a long time. And then I started going to various workshops at the local level, the state level. I started doing kind of online, a lot of webinars. And I started attending in-person education, you know. So I would take actual courses in person for a week in Salt Lake City, and really honed the craft. And one thing that I learned is that you cannot just walk into another industry and say, hey, everybody, I have a PhD, so I deserve mm-hmm. credit
yeah.
and I know what I'm doing. And I think that anybody who does that would be foolish. But unfortunately, a lot of academic institutions kind of train us to think that way
mm-hmm.
about ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's not helpful at all, because, you know, that kind of hubris actually can get in the way and block your ability to learn new skill sets that you need in whatever you're going to do.
Totally. I've had a number of people I've chatted with on the podcast say that in whatever profession they are, that when people come in with an attitude of like, I have a PhD and I'm slumming, you should be happy to hire me, it's a real turnoff to potential employers, because it speaks to your inability to work in a group and to, as you were saying, like, know that you're going to grow and learn more skills in your position. Just because you have a PhD doesn't mean you know everything.
That's exactly right. And I certainly did not know everything about my area. The linguistics to genealogy, it's a stretch. There are connections.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you a couple of stories about some
yeah.
of the connections.
Please.
But there is still a lot to learn about genealogy. So yeah, let me tell you a story. So I was once working on this client's ancestor profile. This is like a little booklet that I write up that profiles an ancestor. And usually it's the immigrant ancestor in the line. So this ancestor had come to the U.S. at the turn of the 20th century. And I collected a large number of documents. And he listed his country of birth really inconsistently in these documents mm-hmm. on the U.S. side. And in those documents, it also listed his language inconsistently. So this is, of course, you know, as a linguist, I go, in one document it appears he was born in Germany. In another, it says Hungary. And yet another, it says Yugoslavia.
Oh, my God.
And it's like Yugo-Slavia, right? So I'm looking at handwriting, too, and thinking about how people are spelling things. And then the passenger records and the immigration forms, his language is reportedly Hungarian. And yet the surname is very German sounding. And then later, I find some newspaper classifieds that claim that he's a German baker looking for an assistant in his bakery. So immediately I was like, oh, having studied like language contact and language policy and planning from my linguistics days, I know very well that people are often bilingual if they live in border
sure.
towns.
Yeah.
And I suspected that perhaps this man lived on the border between Austria and Hungary. And so during his early years in Europe, he most likely spoke German in the home. He probably knew Hungarian for talking in the community. And the Austro-Hungarian Empire was this unified empire that allowed both languages. So I looked up language policy in the empire. Hungarian was the dominant language, and I was able to find his baptism record in Hungarian on his hunch that, you know, from a church in town that today is located in Austria. So this German-speaking man later married a Hungarian woman from a town that's now today located in Serbia, but which was also part of the same empire. And this would explain his mobility. Also required military service would explain the mobility. Mm-hmm. So after the family moved to the U.S. and began to seek naturalization papers, World War I occurred. The Austro-Hungarian Empire was no more. Yugoslavia was created in 1929, I think. And so it had been, you know, called the Kingdom of the Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes. So all of this self-reported inconsistency in languages and birthplaces was the result of a lot of language policy planning, language contact, border changes, and so forth. So linguistics was a perfectly good lens for understanding this puzzle. And that is, you know, a story I like to tell that says, yes, you can apply what you know to new fields.
That's such a fascinating story. Thank you for sharing that. As you were talking, I was just sort of ticking off all the different areas of linguistics that that story touches. So it's historical linguistics, it's sociolinguistics, it's anthropological linguistics, right? It's all those things mixed together, and not needing to be an expert in, you know, specifically any one of those areas, but just knowing that those things intersect. And then also I was thinking there's a certain social component to it where you're now in America, what's the best way to portray yourself, right? Like if you you settle in a predominantly German-speaking area, you're just going to say you're German because, boy, is that a lot easier than having to explain this complicated backstory, right?
Exactly.
Like you're going to do what's going to make life easier for you. Wow, that's so cool. So I'm very interested in sort of the nitty-gritty of how you launched this service. So you had this idea, you mentioned you were taking classes, you were doing this research. Were you doing it primarily through networking? Like, did you launch a website right away? How were you getting clients to start this?
So I launched a website. I started a business by, you know, going down to the city hall and getting my business license and created a logo, you know, all the things that people do when they go, I'm going to launch a business. And then I also talked to a friend who is a lawyer, and I said, hey, what are some of the things I need to be thinking about in terms of contracts? And he said, you know, you need to understand the basics of contract law, because every single client that I have signs a contract. And there are a lot of ethics involved in genealogy because you're working with people's personal information. And especially because I do genetic genealogy in addition to documentary genealogy. And so I'm working also with people's genetic information, which is extremely sensitive.
Yeah, of course.
And so he kind of clued me into some of those things that I needed to be thinking about. And I found the answers to all of those kinds of questions in the genealogy industry. So the industry already has set up a lot of help, right, for people who are getting into it at a professional manner. The American Professional Genealogists is a society that I'm a part of and that I use as a resource constantly. So the website, I did my first client for free in order to get feedback. I asked him if I could do sort of a, you know, a design a research question with him, which is what you normally do. Clients bring you research questions. And if they don't, you help them find a research question. Again, another another way in which academia is very applicable, right? So then you take that research question and you figure out about how many hours, and then you sign a contract. So I asked him to do all this with me. And then I said, I'm going to interview you and have you fill out a survey afterwards in return for doing this for free. And the research question that he brought to me, this is my very first client that's not in my own family, was absolutely phenomenal. It was that he thought that there was this family story, not that he thought there was this family story, but he didn't know if it was real. So he wanted us to figure out whether or not the story was real, that his great-grandfather had beat up a guy that he found in Colorado in bed with his wife. And this was all during the Wild West times. And that the judge said, get out of town. And he left town and never went back. And the woman that he eventually married was this guy's great grandmother. And he said, is this story true? And did they have a child? So I was like, wow, I get to do like a big time mystery.
Yeah.
And in the interest of this person's privacy, I will say, yes, we found out some answers and he was able to learn a little bit about his past. And so that was what got me hooked.
Wow.
And yeah, and he gave me a lot of great feedback. And I think that in general, feedback is fantastic. Very much like, you know, if you're teaching classes and you ask your colleagues to go and watch you teach a class and give you feedback, it's going to improve your work.
Mm-hmm.
Student evaluations, to some extent, are designed to give you, you know, feedback to help you to improve. So I think that in many of the things that I use in academia are definitely relevant to growing in the field. So that's how I got started. And that's how I, you know, continued. It's all been word of mouth.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That makes sense for a business like that. And how long have you been running it as your business?
I started it in 2017. So, you know, 8 years or so.
Yeah.
I'd say it's a lot different now than it was then. At that time, it was just doing genealogy hourly. And then I started getting really into a lot of how can I present this visually? And so I started watching YouTube tutorials on using the Adobe suite. So InDesign and whatnot. And I started actually doing some graphic design and publishing booklets for people.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually I took bookbinding classes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I started doing the books and printing and binding them myself for people. So that has been a really fun sort of artistic outlet. And then I opened it up to genetic genealogy when DNA mm-hmm. kits became all the rage. And I learned a lot about how to do, you know, genetic genealogy as well. So it's just, there's so many places you can go with it.
That's so fascinating. And is it just you or do you have folks that you work with?
So I have a few folks that I work with. None of them are full-time employees yet, but that is the goal, of course. It's very hard to move beyond your one-person business.
Sure.
But I have a very wonderful person who does graphic design for me on contract, and she's amazing. And then I have a friend who, again, the lawyer, who is very good at helping me out with little details here and there mm-hmm. with contract stuff. And then I have a couple other people that do what I call lookups. So if you know somebody that lives close to Salt Lake City, sometimes going in person to the library when I give them a specific lookup helps me to get something that's on microfilm that's not available. And so I have friends that live close to some of those important places. And the rest of the time, I do a lot of contacting local libraries in the regions where I'm doing the research. And sometimes I will hire somebody who I've never met, say on, you know, Upwork or mm-hmm. some site where you can get someone who can then do a lookup in a local library. So mm-hmm. I've had somebody go and take pictures of some archives at the Stanford Library, at Yale before. So it's really nice to be able to do that.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So here's the tough question, and we like to be very open about these things on the podcast. Is this a business that provides enough income for you to support yourself?
It would if I had enough time. And I think that is the problem that most people run into. So I only have so many hours that I can work hourly for a client. And much like lawyers, right, you charge an hourly rate.
Right.
If I raise my rates, I could be making the same that I, you know, would make as a professor. I haven't raised my rates because my rates are about what other people are charging and I'm trying to remain competitive. Mm-hmm. That puts it down just a little bit. If I didn't have a spouse with a sort of regular day job, I don't think it would be possible because the income is sporadic. So mm-hmm. I will have a client who gives me a 20-hour retainer, and that is a big, you know, income all at once. And then I have to put in those 20 hours. But those 20 hours cannot just be done in 1 week because there are times when particular archives are open or you're waiting for a document, mm-hmm. or, you know, you have other clients, or you've got to do marketing, or you've mm-hmm. got to update the website, all these other things. So 20 hours of work ends up getting spread perhaps over a month, depending on what other clients I have and what work is going on.
Right.
So one of the things I do is, and this came up during COVID, because obviously I was not taking people on trips during COVID to walk in the footsteps of their ancestors, is a walking tour of my own city. Mm. And so I do that as well.
That's so cool. I'm glad that you brought up the how the hours get spread out. I do work like that too. And part of what you spend your time doing is also looking for more work, right? Like, you always have to be promoting your business, whether that means writing a blog or posting on LinkedIn. You know, the word of mouth is great, but you always want to just turbo it a little bit so that people can find you if you are the thing that you want them to buy. So it's never just working on projects. There's always, you know, 1,000 other things that you need to be doing to keep your business going.
That's true. And I do have somebody that does help me with marketing. So I have someone that's in charge of social media, but even so, we still have to talk about strategy. Mm-hmm. I still have to answer email inquiries, which is a lot mm-hmm. of work. There is a lot that goes into, you know, just keeping the business running. And the other thing that is a conundrum for me is the travel. It's perhaps the most rewarding part of it. And I really love this because I used to do study abroads with my students when I was teaching. And to me, taking families to another country or to another, even within the US, to another place, and taking them around and teaching them the contextual history of their family, as well as who this person was and what they did and where they walked, right? There's this sense of, you know, time and place. If you can touch the places where people mm-hmm. have been, it's very meaningful. And those trips are fantastically amazing, and I love them. Very rewarding for me, but it's really hard to charge enough to mm-hmm. say that during those trips, I'm not basically doing work for other clients. Mm-hmm. And so while people are paying for my room and board, and they're paying for, say, the rental car that I'm driving them around with, they are not paying me the wages that I'm losing, right?
Right. Right.
And that's an issue if you do that kind of thing. I know this is very specialized, but, you know, these are the kinds of things that business owners have to think about.
Absolutely. We have quite a few career linguists who have done consulting for their own companies, which is very, you know, it's just like what you do. You're running your own little company. And there are so many things that you have to think about, especially those trade-offs that you were just talking about. When you're spending time on one thing, it means you're not spending time on something else. And even if you have help, like you were talking about having someone to help you with social media, you're paying them. So that's money that you aren't keeping for your right. own income. So you have to figure out, well, how much money do I have to spend on this, and where is it going to be used most effectively? So running your business is this whole other project you have to manage in addition to your actual work, which is managing each individual project for a client that comes along.
Yeah, the walking tours, it's a walking tour of the history of my city. Those help a little bit because the tourist season is predictable. I can, from years past, estimate based on, you know, the previous number of tours, number of people in each tour. I can predict for the next year how many tours I will do and in which months I can expect income. So that helps a little bit mm-hmm. to offset some of the other work. And I'll even know, you know, I can't take on a new client because I probably will have a lot of tours mm-hmm. that month and that kind of thing. But originally, I thought running the tour would be easy because there's all this research in the beginning. And then once you've memorized this 2-hour script and you know your walk, and I even have it down to like the minute, I get people back right at the minute. I love it. But the problem is you've got to be keeping track of what's going on in the town. So I have to read the newspaper now to make sure that I hear about little things here and there that are happening, so that as I'm walking around downtown, I can explain what's going on. I have to be in the know. And then, of course, there are always questions that people ask me, and I go, oh, you know, I don't know that. And so I'm always doing more research for my walking tour, even though I had planned on it being sort of you do it and then you don't have to, you know, update it more than, say, once a year. Not true.
I love that you're getting into the nitty-gritty of this. I think it's an underrated aspect of entrepreneurship that people just don't talk about enough. My own experience when I was leaving academia and then going to start a small business, I was very lucky in that my two partners were MBAs. So they knew all about the business side of the business and I knew nothing. And it was pretty much a humbling experience to find out that I knew nothing about anything and had to learn from scratch, you know, profit and loss and projections and budgeting and all the rest of it. It is a crucial part of any business that you want to start yourself. The flip side is that you're your own boss, which is awesome. And for me, it totally fits my personality type, maybe for you too.
It does.
Yeah. And you get to really revel in what you do. Like I can tell just the way you're talking about it, how much you love what you do. I love what I do too. And I find it so much more rewarding than if I was working a 9-to-5 job for somebody else. Even if I was getting paid a lot more than I'm making now, I think I would be unhappy doing that.
You know, that's true. A few times, you know, job ads have come across my lap and I have thought, well, I have the skills for this. And I really do think about it a lot. But there's this sense of resentment that I have, and this is maybe just my personality, that someone else is telling me how to spend an entire 8 hours of my day.
Yeah.
And I have to put aside my enthusiasm and my excitement and this zest for adventure that I have, which really, you know, is what I'm channeling when I do the work that I do. And to put that aside for 8 hours and then have enough energy, you know, in the evening for that, it's just not for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is such an important part of asking people to think about what kind of careers they want to have based on what kind of work environment they think they will thrive in, right? Some people really like what you were just discussing. Like they would like to have someone tell them what to do for 8 hours a day because it frees them from a certain responsibility for arranging their day. Other people like you and me, it's the worst thing in the world. So I always try to get people to consider that when they're thinking about what kind of career they want to have. Where are you going to thrive? Like you could work a 9-to-5 job if you don't like it very much, but ultimately it's not going to be fulfilling for you as a career, right? Like as a thing that you want to keep doing. So it's very important to know what kind of person you are and where you're going to do your best work.
Exactly. And, you know, in the beginning I thought, oh, I'm giving up so many things. I was really worried that I would not earn respect and prestige, I suppose, because I wasn't going to be able to publish. And then I thought, this is ridiculous. I can publish whenever I want.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've published, right? Mm-hmm. I have articles out there. I have a book coming out. It's fine. I can still do the things that I want to do and, you know, lead my own life. And the nice thing about publishing the way I do it is my research agenda is my own.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can do, you know, a project in like Spanish at one point, and then I can move over and do something in linguistic anthropology, and nobody's going to fault me for my own interests and, you know, leading my own life. And that is what I absolutely love about what I do.
Yeah, that's so great. And I want to caveat all this, as we were talking about earlier, by saying this kind of entrepreneurship kind of requires you to have some kind of safety net, right? It's very difficult to do what you've done and what I did if you don't have a partner or you don't have some savings to fall back on because especially in the beginning, you're not quite sure if it's going to work out. So it's risky, but the rewards can be great. And people just have to understand what the risks are as you're going into it because you never know, you know, world events happen, the economy changes, and you're not quite sure where your next client is coming from.
That is true. And I will say for my first few years, money was really tight and it was very difficult and it made it not so fun. So for everybody out there, I understand like you do need a safety net to make it happen. And there was a point at which I took a full-time job because we were in such a difficult position that I felt like any job doing anything was going to make me happier at that moment than what I was trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it did. I got out of the hole. I was able to save up some money. And after a year, I quit the job and I went back to it again. And now we're in a much better place.
Yeah.
So, you know, I completely understand that it's, you know, I was there. I felt that absolute dread that, no, I need to do anything and I'm willing to do anything. So when I say, you know, that I don't want to spend 8 hours doing what someone else is telling me, I say that from a position of now being able to say that.
Right, right. Exactly. And I love, I'm so glad that you just mentioned that experience, because I do think people also get into the mindset of when you make that choice, right, to take a job because you need to pay off your debts or whatever, you're betraying your ideals or you're making an irrevocable choice, and you're not, right? It's just another phase in your career and things are probably going to change. So it's great to be able to go from thing to thing as you find your way to the thing that is actually going to be fulfilling to you in the end.
Indeed.
So can you talk about this? You just mentioned you're writing a book. Can you talk about your book?
Oh, sure. So, well, I'm actually working on two. One is an academic book and the other one is not. So I'll start with the academic book. It actually came about from some research that I was doing when I was finishing up my doctorate. And I met a bunch of people at a conference and we all said, hey, we need to do a book on activist perspectives in translation and interpreting. And I said, that's great. Let's do it. And so we all sort of got together and came up with some chapters. And I have an edited volume that is back from peer review. And I'm just working on the last few reviewer comments. And I'll be sending that back. So it's an edited volume on translation interpreting activist perspectives really around the U.S. So we're focusing on things like wildfire crises in California, the Flint water crisis in Michigan, things like indigenous interpreting for people from Central America in the state of California, things like that. Legal court interpreting in Arizona. So very important issues that are pressing regarding language rights, which is something that I feel very strongly about. And so that's the academic book. The other one, completely different, but you know me, I could probably come up with a connection if I wanted to. But it's actually a memoir about my camper van adventures during COVID. I took my daughter out of school during COVID. She was in kindergarten when COVID hit. I took her out of school. I bought a camper van. I slapped on the logo of my business, Kronos Heritage Services, and I put on there, this is a family history research vehicle. And I did two things at once. I went around the country with my daughter, teaching her first, second, third grade on the road. We visited more than 40 states.
Wow.
And I created a curriculum that was connected to each region of the country where we were, kind of going along with what the Common Core standards for her grades would be. Parallel to that, I continued my genealogy research. I installed a desk that fits. You lift the bed up and you can pull out a desk, and I've had a stool in there. And I actually could go to different local libraries, to history museums, and I could go to archives and say, you know, this archive is only open from 4 to 6 p.m. on Wednesdays. We'd park ourselves there. We'd learn about the region, we'd do her curriculum, and then I would go in and I would do my archival work. So I was able to find a way to, you know, do that balance. This was an incredibly exciting adventure. And so a lot of people kept saying, oh my gosh, I can't believe you were able to create a, you know, elementary school curriculum about van life or around van life. And I said, oh yeah, it's easy. And people said, well, write about it. So that's what I'm working on right now.
Wow. Amazing. That sounds so interesting. I want to read this book. Can I just say, you have the energy of like 10 people. It's kind of amazing. I was thinking, how much coffee does she drink? This is so cool that you're, I mean, I see where the linguistics is informing so much of this in so many different ways. And what did your daughter think of the whole thing? Was it like a big fun adventure?
it was a big fun adventure. As you can imagine, traveling around with your parents 24 hours a day in a small space. I mean, in a way, the entire world is our space, but then also the van is the space. It can get a little bit old. And as she got a little older, she said, you know, I do want to go back to school and do traditional school because I want to make friends. Mm. And we agreed, you know, COVID was pretty much over and we had had a lot of fun, but she was ready for it. And so I honored her wish to go back to school. She has this amazing vest in her room that is that Junior Ranger vest, and it's got like 51 Junior Ranger pins from all the national parks that we visited, and she did all those little booklets. Yeah. And when I think about that kind of thing, that's like an image that I have in my mind of, you know, that experience for her.
Definitely. What an amazing formative experience. I just want to pop back really quickly to the first book that you were talking about, because that's something we've talked about on the podcast as well. In terms of careers, this issue of language rights and translation and the social aspect of it is actually becoming a job market for linguistics, especially in areas of law, but also healthcare, right? Like healthcare companies are finally waking up to the fact that it's not enough to provide, you know, online translations of stuff. You actually need people to be present in a lot of cases for interactions, because it's not just the language, right? It's the social atmosphere that it's taking place in. It's how people answer questions, what kind of information they're willing to volunteer. It's the same in law. It's the same for a lot of social issues. So for people who are linguists, even if you're not completely bilingual, there's places, especially for sociolinguistics, to work in these fields and to do something for the social good, even if it's for a for-profit company. You're actually helping people to get the care and the help that they need in these very, you know, in America anyway, stupidly complicated and painful areas like healthcare, for example.
Healthcare and the legal system, I think, are the two areas that kind of woke up to this first. Mm-hmm. And so there are legal mandates, particularly around the ACA, for various states that receive ACA funding, Obamacare funding, to provide, right, based on demographics, at some minimal access, which means, you know, getting a foot in the door. It's definitely not a place at the table like you could imagine a society that doesn't have this monolingual ideology in which all people's languages are equally valued, where from the very beginning, right, we expect that there might be people who are stronger in other languages besides English in our society. I mean, there are more than, what, 310 languages spoken in the U.S., so this shouldn't really be a surprise. And yet this idea that multilingualism or bilingualism is a temporary problem, I think, is a big problem for the US in particular. Mm-hmm. And that is why I got really interested in that topic. And, you know, when I was working on this book, I was thinking, oh, I don't have an affiliation and I don't like the word independent researcher. So I decided, oh, I'm just going to make a website and call my own research the Language and Heritage Institute, and that way I have a byline. So I did that. And then I couldn't help myself, because I thought, well, this Language and Heritage Institute can do some good, maybe. So then I got involved with a local school that is an elementary school that's a dual language school, and we had this program where we were having the Spanish-speaking parents and the English-speaking parents taking language classes in the opposite language to help their own children with their homework and getting them to actually interact with each other, which is building community. And so that was a fantastic little thing that came out of it. And then the Language and Heritage Institute has been working on maintaining heritage languages and helping families understand what is required in order to maintain a heritage language if they're not receiving support from the school system. So now I'm actually doing a lot of what I would consider sort of activist work in that area. And one branch of it is my linguistics in the K-12 classroom that I'm doing. It's actually just 9 to 12 now. But I have over 21 courses that I'm teaching with other teachers around the country, actually around the world. I've had some classes from Australia and from England, and the students are taking all kinds of linguistics classes. And so we're getting linguistics into the high school classroom. So we're actually teaching people about multilingualism, bilingualism. We're teaching people semantics. My conlang class is extremely popular, as you can imagine. But even, you know, my pirate linguistics, which is about roticity, it's still, people love like those one-off courses. And so the high school outreach has really taken off. And that's another like little fun thing that I get to spend some time working on.
Oh, that's so cool. That's very interesting about bringing linguistics into high schools and even younger, because that seems obvious. And because people don't know what linguistics is, when you talk to them about this, they're like, oh, translation, studying second languages. And it's like, well, that's only one little part of it.
Exactly.
That's really awesome that you're doing all this. And one of the previous guests on the podcast, a guy named Juan Rosas, has had jobs in city government as a language access expert because he's a linguist. And I believe when he was originally interviewing for these positions, it wasn't quite that, but he was able to help them craft a job that didn't exist before. And I think that is also something that linguists can do if they're interested in working in government, is help the government entities actually develop the positions that are really about language access in a way that makes sense linguistically, but also from a socially activist point of view.
Indeed. And I think language access planning is just another really interesting area that's growing out of both, you know, language policy and planning, but also from translation and interpreting studies. And particularly, I think the legal side of things, like law schools and law students, are getting more interested in this. And that has been great. But organizations are, you know, obviously hospitals because they're mandated. Mm-hmm. But when I think of language access, I think this is a great first step because this is just getting minimal rights to people. And in my mind, these rights should exist. It's like this is a gap that we're filling where we really should be providing this. And I'll give you an example. Legally, in California in the 1990s, there was an assembly bill on the floor that said, please do not make it legal for children 15 and under to interpret in medical contexts for their family members, because children should not be doing this. We should not be exposing them to this kind of responsibility to expect them to take on these roles. It went through several iterations, eventually passed, and went to House Appropriations. And House Appropriations said, yeah, that's great, but we need to figure out what the fiscal impact of this is going to be. Mm-hmm. And they put that bill in a little container that is basically saying, we need to figure out, this is going to cost a lot of money, so it needs to go in this little area where we go, this is too much fiscal impact to be decided later. And it never came out. So all these people got to say that they voted for something, which is to protect these children from having to talk, you know, tell their family members that they have cancer and stuff.
Sure.
This is very serious kinds of things that we should not be having children do. And the fiscal impact of language brokering was so high that it did not get passed in my state. That's just one small example of, you know, how the legal system is finally starting to figure things out. I'm seeing, for example, different groups like bar associations saying, hey, language access is actually an important issue, and they're taking it up and they're working with linguists on this. So go work with people in legal fields if you're a linguist, because they're taking up language access. I'd like to see language justice rather than language access. So like language access being the foot in the door kind of thing, where at least you're getting like a paper translated for yourself. You still have to sit on the back couch, right? You come into the conference room, you get a seat at the back couch, right? You get to put on the headphones and listen to the simultaneous interpreting, but you don't get to ask questions and so forth because the system's just not set up for that. I'd say language justice is where everybody has a seat at the table.
Yeah.
That takes a lot of planning.
I totally agree. There are so many areas where language is a crucial part of whether justice is served or not. I've mentioned this before, but I was astonished when I found out that the government, the federal government and state governments as well, but the feds especially, when they are reviewing tapes of conversations with informants or secret recordings, they don't have linguists listening to those tapes and making the transcriptions. They're just people. It's like, I can't even believe that that is the way it's done. But of course it should be linguists, right? Because normal people don't know how to listen to a tape. And especially if it's more than one language or there are social differences, the transcription is just going to be wrong. And people's lives depend on transcriptions or interpretations of what people are saying where there are cops present or, criminals present. And that is like, that needs to be fixed from the ground up. I don't know how that happens, but it's something that infuriates me every time I come across it.
Agreed.
So you've had this amazing career. I'm just astonished by all the things that you've done. Where do you see your career going from here?
Well, I'm really happy with the way that Kronos Heritage Services has grown, and I'm happy with where I am right now. Mm-hmm. I would like, of course, to have a steady stream of clients. Currently, I'm impacted. That means that I have enough clients that I cannot take on another one without leaving a client behind. So either a client that is paying me on retainer, every month saying, yes, do 10 more hours or 20 more hours of research, then I continue with them. And a new person contacts me and I will say, well, I can put you on a waiting list, but I actually can't take any new clients right now. Mm-hmm. That is a good place to be in.
Yeah.
But it's also in some ways a frustrating place because I could take on more clients if I could scale the business a little bit.
Right.
And so I think probably in the future, the next step will be finding a partner for the business. In terms of the Language and Heritage Institute, which really just started as, I just want my own byline, my own affiliation, and now it's turning into something bigger, I'm enjoying teaching high school students linguistics. People would be shocked to hear the talents that many high school students have for, really complex morphology problems, really interesting phonology work. And they're very interested in it. They eat it up. And I think that just developing language awareness, even though, my institute has this mission that has to do with language rights and maintaining language, the fact that these high school students are learning structural linguistics means that they are appreciating language diversity. They are understanding what language diversity is, what the human capacity for language is. It's a great start. And so I would like to expand that. I would like to be able to reach out to more teachers and work with them. Post-COVID, we're just getting back on being able to do partnerships with teachers. So that's a pretty big thing. Right now, I have a lot of private students, and I would like to be able to open this up more. So that's an area that I'd like to continue. I want the Language and Heritage Institute to actually become a real institute, right? Mm-hmm. Not that it isn't, but I would like to have public policy papers on the site, and I'd like to have people doing research for it. It would be one of the only independent of a university or independent of an institution for support that would be doing what we're doing. And so I think that would be a great growth for me to have.
Oh, that is fantastic. And the wonderful byproduct is that you're creating more linguists, right? Little linguists in high school.
Exactly.
And we can't have enough linguists. I think there are so many jobs for which we always say, oh, you need a linguist for that. And if there are linguists and people are willing to understand what linguistics is and how it can be applied, there will be just an endless stream of jobs for people in every aspect. We talk a lot about tech, but what you're doing is so different, but yet so meaningful in this way and is actually, like it's legitimate employment. It's not what I was trying to get at when I was talking about, your business and how you do it. It's not a hobby for you, right? Like it's a real business and the Institute is a real thing. It's not just a dilettante thing. It's something where you're taking all of this knowledge that you have and applying it in a way that's really meaningful for people.
Yeah, I really, it started as, how about I try this? I thought I was a dilettante. I think all of us have, some degree of some sort of imposter syndrome. So my feeling was always, well, I don't really know what I'm doing. And the years go by And people come to me and ask me questions now when they're getting into the field, or, you know, when I'm working with teachers in linguistics, and I will say, well, I'm not an expert in this. And they go, well, you've been teaching, you know, your online class for 5 years, and you've taught, you know, hundreds of students. And I go, oh, well, okay.
Yeah.
So at least I won't call myself an expert, but I have experience and expertise that, you know, comes from that. So yes, it takes a while to get there.
Yep, totally agree. I've had this conversation with so many people, and yeah, you're an expert. You're far more an expert than most people, I would say. So you've given such a great overview. If people want to get in touch, like if they're interested in the Language and Heritage Institute, can they contact you either via the website or via your LinkedIn account?
Of course, yes.
Okay.
So probably LinkedIn is one of the best ways to contact me.
Okay. I will put that in the notes. I will also put in the links for the Language and Heritage Institute and the Kronos Heritage Service also, in case people want to find out about that. Serena, this has been so cool. I am so delighted to learn about what you've been doing and what your plans are. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me today.
Well, I appreciate you asking me all these questions. It's exciting. And, you know, you've given me some high praise, and it's motivating me to get out and get to work and do more.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, thank you again for your time.
Thank you.
Linguistics Career Launch 2021 was a one-month intensive program intended to familiarize linguistics students and faculty with career options beyond academia in business, tech, government, and nonprofit organizations. Videos of all our recorded sessions are available on our YouTube channel. LCL 2021 was organized by Nancy Frischberg, Alexander Johnston, Emily Pace, Susan Steele, and Laurel Sutton. You can get in touch at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.